Hello, good morning. I just want to apologise on behalf of Dr. Julie Maxton, the Executive Director of the Royal Society, who was originally billed. She's very unwell and apologise that she can't be here herself today. So we've heard a lot over the last day and a bit about the changing landscape of science and the increasing importance of international cooperation in science, technology and innovation, particularly as national budgets come under increasing pressure and as we tackle shared global challenges together. So I'm going to pick up on some of the issues that these raise and that Alan has raised as well, on how we might develop a more coherent and compatible science enterprise using some of the Royal Society's work, the Royal Society being the UK's National Science Academy, in addition to wider UK efforts. And these are some of the practical examples that we think may have a role. So just looking at global challenges as an example, we know that science and scientific collaboration are essential to address global challenges. We heard a lot about that yesterday. But this presents challenges in itself. Global challenges are interdependent and interrelated, yet many global assessment and research programs are managed separately. There are various global and regional initiatives, not necessarily optimized to address the global problems of the 21st century. There are many players and many different forms of partnership that endeavour to reconcile cultural and operational differences. There are many different ways of doing things with different levels of accountability. Science is essential for addressing these challenges, but it can't do so in isolation. So we need to think about how we weave it around social science, economics, and politics. These are all crucial factors, and we need to be able to bring all these together in some way. There's also a tension around inclusivity and quality. All countries have a stake in tackling global challenges, and capacity building is crucial to enable better local assessment and response and to build a more resilient global infrastructure. So in spite of these things, global challenges are and must be increasingly important as a component of national and international science strategies, funding mechanisms, and global scientific discourse. So how do we improve the coherence and compatibility? We know that science is likely to continue to be delivered overwhelmingly through national infrastructure and funding systems. Even in the European Union, only 5% of all research conducted in Europe is delivered through regional cooperation. To remain competitive and to be part of the global effort to address shared problems, countries must connect and collaborate with the very best science, scientists, and infrastructure in the world, wherever they are. So how do we optimize national strategies so that they are fit for purpose in an ever-globalized world? How do we reconcile the practicalities of national systems with the realities of international cooperation? Firstly, governments should continue to support international science by embedding international activities and collaboration into their national science and innovation strategies, and by continuing to meet commitments to multinational research efforts and infrastructure. This would include things like international subscriptions. Governments should encourage, support, and facilitate international science collaboration through research and mobility grants and other mechanisms that support research networks. By minimizing barriers to the flow of talented people, ensuring that migration and visa regulations are practicable and do not impede access. And by designing national research policies that are flexible and adaptive to ensure that international collaboration is not stifled by bureaucracy. Research funding and assessment should be reformed to support and reward interdisciplinary research. National and international strategies should be fit for purpose in addressing global challenges, devising better coordination, sharing of good practice, minimizing duplication, and maximizing impact. Creating strong global challenge research programs to align with scientific, commercial, and public interests, and relying on a robust evidence-based policymaking to devise appropriate responses to global challenges. Systems of peer review, of publishing protocols, and research codes of conduct should be harmonized to facilitate cooperation, and we heard a few examples just now. And there should be a commitment to capacity building, ensuring that the impacts of scientific research are shared globally. At the same time, we need to be learning from existing global infrastructure and systems that can provide valuable lessons in designing, participating in, and benefiting from global research. Are there different models of governance that we could deploy? Should we resist creating new permanent infrastructure and perhaps think about more temporary, bespoke stakeholder fora that bring together diverse communities that can be deployed and then disbanded once they've served their purpose? This would undoubtedly make us more agile and more responsive, but perhaps also less accountable. We need better metrics and indicators for evaluating science. UNESCO and other agencies like the OECD have a role to play here in investigating new ways in which trends in global science can be captured, quantified, and benchmarked. We need to recognize the important relationship between science and good governance, that scientific values of rationality, transparency, and universality help underpin good governance. Science informs evidence-based policymaking and can provide models for brokering new or different types of partnership. And finally, we need to be anticipating future challenges for science. An example here is the growth of citizen science and public accountability of science. How do we reconcile freedom of information with data protection? How do we manage increasingly huge data sets and their access? The Royal Society is presently exploring some of these issues through its Science as a Public Enterprise, or SAPE, study. This is a major piece of work that is exploring the principles, opportunities, and problems of sharing and disclosing scientific information. And it asks how this information should be managed to support innovative and productive research that reflects public values. So, standing here as a representative of the Royal Society, national science academies and learned societies and other such institutions, we believe, have a real important role to play here in bringing coherence and compatibility to the science enterprise. The Royal Society's Science Policy Centre was launched last year to strengthen the voice of science in UK, European, and international policy, and to champion the contribution that science and innovation can make to economic prosperity, quality of life, and environmental sustainability. At the same time, society has become a hub for debate around science, society, and public policy. And pictured here is a picture of Angela Merkel, who spoke at the Royal Society in April last year. And it allowed us to experience at first hand some of the drivers and developments in Germany. And that sort of hub for debate, I think, tries to promote this sort of coherence and mutual understanding of our respective research systems. The creation of the Science Policy Centre reflects our ongoing commitment to rational inquiry and evidence as the basis for good decision-making. We provide authoritative and independent advice on a range of public policy issues underpinned by science, including global challenges. And we also feel that a modern National Science Academy should play a prominent role in monitoring the health of both its own and the international science base, and assembling evidence to support investment, as well as articulating the national value of international collaboration. It should also be promoting schemes that are flexible enough to be able to respond to developments in international science. A couple of examples here of the reports the Royal Society has recently produced to contribute to these sorts of debates. One is the Scientific Century, which demonstrated the critical role of science in securing national economic prosperity, and then Knowledge Networks and Nations, which you heard a lot about yesterday with Professor Christopher Llewellyn-Smith, which is the international equivalent, really, to the Scientific Century, setting out the importance of international science collaboration. And there are copies of each of these reports outside what are left. Otherwise, please visit our website. Here are some of the other things that the Society does to help, albeit in modest ways, to bring coherence and compatibility to the science enterprise. The aims of our international work are largely threefold. The first is to facilitate research collaboration with the very best researchers from outside the UK. Examples of this are perhaps our flagship programme, the Newton Fellowship Scheme, which is open to the very best researchers, early stage postdoctoral researchers in the world. And it encourages them to work in the UK institutions for 2 years, And then they're provided money for up to 10 years after that to be able to support networking with UK scientists and institutions after their time in the UK. The success rate for this is 7%. It's a highly competitive scheme, but it sort of engenders some of the things that we're trying to talk about in this session. We also try to encourage international cooperation on science policy. You'll have heard some examples today of inter-academy working just this morning. And it brings an international voice of science into the global policy debate, working with other academies in Europe, the G8 and globally, and forming important strategic partnerships on wide-ranging policy issues, examples such as synthetic biology and its governance, and on the governance of solar radiation management as part of a potential geoengineering solution. And thirdly, we promote individual and institutional scientific capacity building in developing countries to help their scientific communities engage in global research programs and policy discussions. And we have Pfizer and Leverhulme-funded programs that help us do this. We also play a leadership role in the governance of international science and inter-academy organizations. Our general policy here is to share good practice, policy and research concerns, to encourage sound management, strategic planning and financial sustainability, and to discourage the proliferation of organizations, forging partnership and mergers where possible, as well as building capacity and capability. The IAC review of IPCC, which again you heard about this morning, is a good illustration of how science academies and these kinds of institutions can get involved in an advisory capacity on international science governance. We participate in international meetings and debates, like this meeting, the World Science Forum, the STS Forum, and AAAS meetings. But could we do more in bringing a coherence to these so that they genuinely progress debate and promote best practice? There are lots of good intentions at these sorts of meetings, but are we missing opportunities to really advance our thinking and our practice? The Society is very fortunate to enjoy the privilege of working closely with, but independently from, the UK government and our research communities. We have a seat at the table in bilateral government-to-government joint commissions and on a cross-government forum of research delivery, commissioning and funding agencies, the Global Science and Innovation Forum. This is chaired by our government chief scientific advisor, and each government department now has a chief scientific advisor to ensure that science is embedded right across government. Many of these chief scientific advisors are FRSs, the Fellows of the Royal Society, and they have national and international remits. So this brings coherence in both our national and our international delivery of science, as does a network of science and innovation attachés that are funded by the UK government that we draw on a day-to-day basis. These are established in 25 countries, and they provide intelligence on in-country developments in science and innovation. They broker partnerships at individual and institutional levels, and they showcase UK science and innovation strengths. They are an important part of the UK's science diplomacy effort. Just continuing on the theme here, this is my penultimate slide, on models that we use in the UK to try and improve the compatibility of the UK system with working internationally. The UK government continues to test a number of different models for international science cooperation, largely at a bilateral level, joint commissions, thematic focal points, science bridges, mobility schemes, and joint research frameworks. You'll probably know that the UK research system is highly devolved. There are many organisations, many councils and institutions that conduct research in the UK. So in order to simplify systems and minimise fragmentation, our 7 UK research councils, who invest annually in around £3 billion worth of research, work together through RCUK, the Research Councils UK. This is a partnership that increases the collective visibility, leadership, and policy influence of the research councils internationally. It provides a single focus for collective dialogue with international stakeholders, and it ensures greater harmonization of operational and administrative functions across the councils. In short, it makes it easier for international stakeholders to navigate the UK research funding system and for the UK research councils to bring a coherent message to potential partners overseas. RCUK also has 4 overseas offices in Brussels, Washington, Delhi, and Beijing. Much like the Science and Innovation Attaché Network, They gather intelligence on the strategic and research priorities of major overseas funding agencies and institutions. They build partnerships with overseas funding agencies to align strategic priorities and set the scene for sustainable joint research programs. They help to overcome institutional barriers to form productive relationships with the research base. And they increase the RC UK presence and work with other UK stakeholders in country to promote UK research and its impact. A barrier to collaborative international funding is the risk that a proposed joint project will be approved in one country but not in another. RC UK aims to simplify decision making to ensure that projects are assessed under a single peer review system when they are funded by more than one organisation from more than one country. For example, under an RC UK FAPESPI, which is the science funding agency in Sao Paulo, under an agreement between these two organisations, researchers from the UK and Brazil may apply for funds from both countries. And we have a similar situation in China, a similar partnership. The G8 Hawks Initiative, these are the heads of research councils, they have an initiative on multilateral funding that supports excellent research on topics of global relevance which can best be tackled by a multinational approach. Funding enables researchers to cooperate in consortia of at least three partners from three of the participating countries. And finally, there's the European equivalent, Science Europe, that was launched this year and brings together 50 research performing and funding organisations from across Europe. It will promote the collective interests of its member organisations, streamline the coordination of policies and activities, and could perhaps form the basis for similar regional models elsewhere and in the future. And on that note, this networking map, it shows EU collaboration during the period 1996 to 2000, and then 2004 to 2008 on the right. And you'll see that intra-European collaboration has grown exceptionally faster than international collaboration in general, largely as a result of deliberate EU policy designed to improve coherence and compatibility across the 27 highly differentiated member states. Some of the lessons learned from the EU regional cooperation experience, of which there are many, can certainly help inform other regional cooperation efforts. And I think we'll hear more on this later. And finally, just to put the faces onto some of these things, if we look at the UK Nobel Prize winners, Andre Geim and Konstantin Novoselov, both FRS scientists, they may work in Manchester, but both were born in Russia. They've worked in the Netherlands, and they're funded through a range of sources, including the European Research Council. The UK may have a claim for Andre and Konstantin as their own, but so did Russia and Europe. These two scientists are representatives of the UK global outlook of researchers, and there's something we should be encouraging and facilitating. Thank you.